administration or on the board of trustees pointed the finger at Mahmoud Khalil, who's in prison in an immigration jail in Louisiana. A judge in New Jersey ruled his case should be held in New Jersey, dealt with in New Jersey. Not clear what's going to happen to him in Louisiana. His wife, Dr. Noor Abdullah, a dentist here in New York, is about to give birth to their first child. Your response to all that's taking place?
You know, Mahmoud Khalil has been was the first student who was detained by this administration and disappeared. Now there are several others who are in the same situation as him. Mahmoud Khalil was, as many people know, was a student at Columbia. And, you know, when I was on your show last discussing this, I mentioned that there was a forward report that mentioned that the Columbia institution actually, it seemed as if it was colluding with immigration enforcement, which is incredibly abhorrent. This is not something that any institution should be doing in working with immigration and customs enforcement on wrongfully detaining and removing their student. So kudos to the students continuing to protest for his release and demanding accountability in the university.
And you were referring to the Jewish newspaper, The Forward. Murad Awada, yes. Thank you so much for being with us, president of the New York Immigration Coalition. To see all our coverage of the protest, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the nonprofit Urban League of Portland, presenting its job fair Tuesday, April 8th from 11 to 3 at the Crown Plaza. The event will include career coaches and small and large businesses. More info at ulpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
The people of Portland speaking up about housing and homelessness, why Social Security is now at the center of fierce debate, and Pacific Northwest senators are fighting back against the Trump administration.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday,
April 3rd,
2025. I'm Minette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us.
Portland City Council is hearing from hundreds of people about housing and homelessness. As a public hearing that started yesterday continues today, they've unanimously approved a study of social housing.
During the lengthy public comment on the proposal, Michelle Hornbeck described what it felt like to escape homelessness.
I'm part of Welcome Home Coalition, and I came today to say that I support this resolution. We must find a way to be able to house people. So speaking from the other side, as a person who was homeless, that sense of safety is so important. The Helen Swindell Hotel on Broadway and Burnside years ago was a hotel. And what they've done is now they just rent the rooms out on a monthly basis. And they're part of Portland Housing Authority. They receive payments from them, whatever. When I stayed, I just paid out of pocket. But it was the sense that I could go in and lock a door and know that I would be safe for the night. And we just have too many people out there that feel alone and hopeless. And you have the power to make that not their reality anymore. And I'm sorry, I get emotional because I know how hard it is out there. And when you have a roof, someplace you can rest, you can be more productive, You can look for a job. You can take care of your medical problems or at least see a doctor. You can eat properly. When you're homeless, you don't have that. You don't have any of that. And that's why we lose people on a daily basis. We have people with mental health that rely on drugs in order to cope with whatever issue that is, but also just to get through. So it's so important, and I would just urge you from my heart, I know how grateful I am. I have affordable housing, and I've been there a couple years now, and it really has changed my life. Thank you.
If the city administrators and staff study due in May finds it feasible, the city could start keeping a stock of housing units with permanently affordable rents for people living in Portland. Councilors Candace Avalos and Mitch Green drafted the resolution.
The purpose of this resolution is to study how we can bring social housing to Portland. Publicly owned, permanently affordable homes that keep rent fair and prioritize people over profit. This is a model that works great in places like Vienna and Singapore and even parts of the United States. My co-sponsor, Councillor Green, and I are pushing for this study because we believe it's time for Portland to seriously explore how social housing can become part of our solution to the housing crisis.
I'm very excited about social housing, and so naturally I'm bringing forward this resolution with Councillor Avalos. Appreciate your leadership on this to get this process going. I'm also an institutionalist, and I believe that big policy moves that may depart from established practices or settled habits of thought should be grounded in careful consideration of its impacts or interactions with our already existing norms, rules, policies, and practices. We are fortunate to have a housing bureau with specific expertise and interest in this issue, with the resources to show us how we can best implement social housing in Portland. I also want to acknowledge that Portlanders are weary of the study plan cycle that generates reports that may sit on a shelf and never be used, and that too many Portlanders are suffering from a housing crisis that burdens their household budgets, or worse, leaves them out in the cold. It is my intention that this city council will be remembered as the body that looked at the dire state of housing affordability and said enough, no more. We're bringing every tool we have to the problem to address affordability at its root causes. I believe that for social housing in this city to stand the test of time and to deliver for Portlanders, we owe it to ourselves to get it right. And this resolution gives Director Hisrick the direction she needs to show us the way.
The new council's considering its first new law, which would make the use of artificial intelligence to set rents illegal. Marcel Guzmundo, a lawyer who represents housing providers, warned.
I'm an attorney that focuses and specializes in housing law and represents housing providers in the area and across the state. I'm here on behalf of Multifamily Northwest, though, which represents about 300,000 units in the state and the greater area. I'm not here to support price fixing. I don't believe anybody is, but I do oppose the proposed ordinance as drafted. It does, in fact, prohibit housing providers from using publicly available information when setting rents. If you read the statute, it certainly does not exempt it in any way. It also prohibits property managers from considering their own internal data and expertise when setting rents. Property managers represent different owners. They might represent two different owners on different sides of the street, and you're essentially asking them to put on blinders when they're setting rents, even though that's basically impossible. The city council hasn't had adequate time to really take into account all the stakeholder input and other information that it didn't receive. And as a result, it would be hasty to set this policy that, though while well-intentioned, will inadvertently add to Portland's reputation as being a hostile place to build. Worse yet, the ordinance is so broadly worded with such a disproportionate penalty provision that it could potentially bankrupt any housing provider for factoring in advertised rates or their own data when setting rents.
Chris Olson's among the many supporters.
I'm a renter and I'm a resident in District 2 and a member of the Portland Democratic Socialists of America Housing Working Group. I'm going to be speaking on my own behalf, but also of the experience of renters that I've met through this working group. I strongly support this evidence. As a lifelong renter, I've experienced firsthand the relentless rise in housing costs. Despite working hard to keep up with rent, the increases constantly outpace my wage growth, making it nearly impossible for many Portlanders, including myself, to get ahead. This ordinance is necessary because algorithmic pricing software enables landlords and property managers to artificially inflate rents, effectively engaging in price fixing that puts stable housing further out of the reach of many working people. Through the Portland DSA Housing Working Group, we have heard from hundreds of renters across the city. Portland's housing market is already unaffordable for many, and the use of secretive, profit-maximizing algorithms only worsens the crisis.
America's allies are concerned about President Trump's plans for NATO. Secretary of State Marco Rubio tried to reassure them. As KBOO's Josh Salem reports,
U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio was recently appointed as the Trump administration's new envoy to NATO. Now he is trying to reassure nervous members of that alliance that the United States remains committed. The Trump administration has repeatedly hinted NATO is no longer relevant to the U.S. Nonetheless, Rubio called the media's interpretations of Trump's intentions hysteria and hyperbole. He met with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte today at NATO headquarters in Brussels. It's the broader site of a NATO foreign ministers meeting. Many attending were hoping Rubio would shed light on U.S. security plans in Europe. Rubio said just before the meeting, quote, "The United States is as active in NATO as it has ever been. In some of this hysteria and hyperbole that I see in the global media and some domestic media in the United States about NATO is unwarranted," end quote. He added, quote, "President Trump's made clear he supports NATO." The U.S. ambassador to NATO, Matthew Whitaker, said, quote, "Under President Trump's leadership, NATO will be stronger and more effective than ever before, and I believe that a robust NATO can continue to serve as a bedrock of peace and prosperity," end quote. Despite those words, European and Canadian allies appear to be deeply concerned by Trump's apparent interest in becoming closer to Russian President Vladimir Putin, who sees NATO as a threat. Trump's imposition of huge new global tariffs, which will affect our allies adversely, have added to the uncertainty and fear. French Foreign Minister Jean-Noël Barrot said NATO's unity is, quote, "being tested by the decisions taken and announced yesterday by President Trump," end quote. Asked about concerns among European allies about a possible U.S. troop withdrawal, Rutte said, quote, "These issues are not new. There are no plans for them to all of a sudden draw down their presence here in Europe," end quote. Several European countries appear convinced that U.S. troops and equipment will be withdrawn, and they want to find out from Rubio how many and when. An unnamed senior NATO diplomat wants to preempt a rapid retreat. In Washington, D.C., the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee criticized mid-level leadership at the Pentagon for what he called a misguided plan to reduce drastically the number of U.S. troops based in Europe. It was not immediately clear whom he was calling out. Around 100,000 U.S. troops are stationed in Europe, along with the Navy's 6th Fleet and nuclear warheads. U.S. firepower seems vital to demonstrate that NATO's ability to deter Russia is credible. U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth warned last month that American security priorities lie elsewhere, in Asia and on the United States' own borders. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Lauren Novikoski works at Social Security, but not for much longer. She's retiring.
I have been with the agency for more than 30 years. I'm also the secretary of Local 3937, American Federation of Government Employees, our union, which represents the workers in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Alaska. I have been at my job through 5 presidents, 16 Social Security acting commissioners and commissioners, and 5 government shutdowns, when I had to report to work without being paid. So the reason that I chose this job and stayed with it for so long is because I really care about helping people and I think I'm pretty good at it. But I'm glad to lend my perspective. We need to make it clear that Social Security has never been under this kind of targeted and callous attack as we're seeing. I was not expecting to be leaving now this year. I'm just exhausted. I'm demoralized, just like a lot of other employees around the region. We are under constant stress, and it takes a toll on our physical and mental health. Social Security has consistently, by a polling of our own employees, been placing last of the best federal agencies to work in the last several years. Back 10, 15 years ago, we were number 2. So it's really declined. And for over a decade, our staffing numbers have been just going down while the people that we serve has been growing, like the boomer generation who needs our services. Every single retirement claim that we do, every disability claim, every Social Security number replacement card, those are all real people. And we know that. We work directly with the public who are often in very difficult times in their lives when they need us. We need to be able to help them quickly, we are told that we're the face of this agency. And so how do you think it feels when I come to work every day? I'm bombarded with voicemails, calls, dozens of people a day demanding to know, when are you going to get to my case? When are you going to help me? When is my check going to arrive? And I don't have time to help even half of them. And so as the face of the agency, I'm the one that they get angry at. And then my management team tells me that it's probably my fault that I'm not keeping up. People are waiting days or weeks just to hear back from us. They're waiting hours to call our number, and then they get hung up on because of the crappy phone system. The field office, it takes a couple of weeks or more to even get an appointment, if you can even reach us on the phone, or they come and wait in the lobby and the waiting times are going up to 1-2 hours and higher. And that goes on all day long. So the workers are stressed. The public is stressed. Just a few of the things that I wanted to point out as a worker in the field offices that have been happening in the past couple months that are just inefficient and destructive for our agency. Telework was completely canceled. That was one of the major factors of job satisfaction and productivity. That's gone. The famous, what did you do last week? 5 bullets emails that we all have to fill out every week. I've been recycling the same bullet points for weeks. Nobody reads them. Nobody cares. It's just a power play. I wrote something as simple as I communicated with my supervisor. I helped the public in English and Spanish. And apparently I'm going to be in trouble by who if I don't do it? Elon Musk? I don't work for him. This requirement about forcing people to come into offices, if they can't prove their identity online, they're going to be forced to come to the office. The acting deputy commissioner of operations, Doris Diaz, has written a memo stating that she thinks this is going to cause 75,000 to 85,000 people a week, more than what we're already serving, to come into the offices. So that's going to crash our wait times. There's no place to sleep in a lobby, but that might happen. When the Social Security Agency has to reallocate somebody like me, I am a GS-12. I am one of the highest paid non-management people. I've been working here for 30 years. I should be spending my time adjudicating claims, doing complex work, getting people paid. But instead, I have to spend one day a week in the lobby doing GS-5 workloads, which are very important, but I could be better use elsewhere, moving things along. And instead, I'm out in front answering people's questions, printing out letters, trying to answer questions about Medicare, which honestly isn't my specialty. And so it's just not efficient. When this administration appointed Acting Commissioner Leland Dudek and they nominated Commissioner Frank Bisignano, that is just another trend of this administration appointing agency heads who do not believe in their own administration, and they're just going to actively work to dismantle it. So it's really disheartening. So I just feel tremendous guilt for leaving my coworkers behind. I feel like I'm in the last lifeboat off of a sinking ship. So it's hard for me to make the decision to leave. I just want to say that we, the workers, we're serious, hardworking people, and we are taxpayers too, just like the people who rely on Social Security. We expect the representatives that we elected to take care of the program and to strengthen it. I don't think we should let Social Security be toyed with by the people who have no stake in it, and they have no concern for the ramifications to real people.
Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray, the leading Democrat on the Senate Appropriations Committee, is also warning.
They are firing workers and encouraging them to leave en masse. They are shuttering offices across the country. They are throwing up barriers for seniors and people with disabilities. They are jamming up the phone lines and wait times, and they're doing it without a care in the world. Seriously, they may as well be telling people who need Social Security, good luck, you're on your own. After all, Trump's own Commerce Secretary basically said he doesn't think anyone will mind if their benefits get cut off for a month or two. And if you did complain, perhaps it's because you're a fraudster. Does he know any real people? I don't think so. And Elon hasn't shown the slightest concern that while he is leading a witch hunt for dead people on Social Security, SSA has incorrectly declared living people dead, including in Washington State, and wrongly stole thousands of dollars in benefits out of people's bank accounts.
And that was Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, clear skies, down to 38. Tomorrow's weather, partly cloudy, a high near 70. Today in history, on this date in 1934, English primatologist and conservationist Jane Goodall was born. She was first to observe tool use among chimpanzees. Our quote of the day is from Goodall, "Only if we understand can we care. Only if we care will we help. Only if we help shall they be saved." Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden's been urging his fellow senators to vote against many of President Trump's nominees, including his pick to lead the Social Security Administration. Wyden, the lead Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee, asked Frank Bisignano about his involvement in Elon Musk's efforts to cut government spending called DOGE.
"Were you involved in discussions about DOGE or any of the operations, personnel, or management decisions with those working at Social Security?"
"No, sir."
"So that sounds like a reassuring response, but unfortunately, it's not true."
Wyden says he has a statement from a senior official who worked at Social Security and recently left the agency.
"The whistleblower says that the nominee insisted on personally approving several key DOGE hires at the agency and getting frequent briefings."
The Finance Committee will decide whether to recommend Bisignano's confirmation to the full U.S. Senate.
"After the hearing, the Washington Post newspaper spoke to multiple sources and independently verified the whistleblower's account. So this development has created a trust gap between the nominee and the American people before he's even in the door. He handpicked DOGE agents and pressured Social Security employees to cut corners to get them on the job faster. He told Social Security staff not to hire anybody without his explicit approval. He was aware of plans to shutter regional offices, close the offices of civil rights, anti-fraud, and modernization. He was aware of DOGE's plans to reduce the workforce by thousands of people. He was also aware of sweeping personal data that DOGE agents were requesting, and that those requests flew in the face of privacy law and agency safeguards to ensure Americans' most valuable personal information is protected. Social Security is effectively the Fort Knox of Americans' private information. Banking information, medical records, home addresses, children's names, and more. It is still not completely clear what information DOGE has access to and what they are doing with it. So under this cloud of deception, as the ranking Democrat in the Finance Committee, at a minimum, there ought to be a bipartisan investigation into the allegations. And if that confirms what the whistleblower has told my staff, as I believe it will, this nominee ought to withdraw. My Republican colleagues have an opportunity to prove they simply won't tolerate being lied to at the Senate Finance Committee. The stakes are too high for seniors and Americans with disabilities who are terrified of losing their earned benefits."
Next came Washington Senator Maria Cantwell.
"Thank you, Senator Wyden. Social Security is a contract between citizens and their government, so they can retire with dignity. 1.4 million people in the state of Washington want what they sacrificed and paid in to have that retirement. But what have they gotten out of the Trump administration? The Trump administration has taken many steps to undermine Social Security. First, cutting the workforce. Then trying to cut offices. Then coming up with a suggestion that you should re-register to even qualify for Social Security. Is that any way to meet the contractual obligation our government has to help people have a minimal amount of dignity in retirement? But no, instead, this administration is trying to claim fraud. We heard the President of the United States go on and on at the State of the Union about fraud. Mr. President, it is your billionaire cabinet and DOGE leader that are defrauding the American public from their right to retirement with Social Security. One of my constituents had the unfortunate mishap of being claimed dead. Literally, they said he was dead and should not get a Social Security check. Not only did he have to go back down to the office in Seattle to try to reclaim his check and stand in line for hours and hours, he found out that they had clawed back his previous Social Security checks from January and December. So why does my constituent have to live through what is just a barrage of DOGE people trying to claim fraud when he can't even get his own retirement? Mr. Johnson said the Social Security Administration needs more resources, not less resources. If you have a contractual obligation to give them their check that they paid into, then give it to them in a timely basis. And Secretary Lutnick's ridiculous idea that somehow that a senior, I guess he is so out of touch with the American people that he doesn't understand that people are depending on that for a lifeline. And yet he thinks they can wait months and months to find out. And he's helping empower an organization that is clawing back the checks out of people's bank accounts when they desperately need it for food and medicine. I hope this administration will pay attention to these obligations and understand that they are advocating for undermining of Social Security, undermining people who deserve the benefits, and undermining our obligation to help people retire with dignity.
President Trump announces worldwide tariffs. Democrats decry Liberation Day as the economy adjusts to the news. And some Republicans break from Trump's trade stance.
With more on the stories we're watching, here's today's edition of 2025 Talks.
This is one of the most important days, in my opinion, in American history. It's our declaration of economic independence.
President Donald Trump is imposing new tariffs on most of the world. Speaking from the White House Rose Garden, he announced a 10% baseline levy on all imports taking effect Saturday, with higher rates for nations the administration calls bad actors. China will face a 34% tariff, Japan will see 24%, and the European Union will face 20%. Stock futures across the board dropped after the announcement, and many of America's largest trading partners are promising retaliation. Trump has long been threatening what he has described as reciprocal levies on every trading partner, and during the announcement said the system of post-World War II global commerce led America to be looted, pillaged, raped, and plundered. He had already imposed 25% tariffs on imported cars, tariffs against Canada and Mexico, and steep levies on steel and aluminum. Most economists are pessimistic about a trade war, citing higher prices and job losses. Studies show if the tariffs are active for more than 3 months, the U.S. won't see any economic growth in 2025. Though President Trump is calling it Liberation Day, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries is calling it Recession Day.
Costs aren't going down in America. They're going up. And the Trump tariffs are going to make things more costly in the United States of America.
Trump has justified his policy as rebuilding American manufacturing, but Jeffries argues that was already happening under President Joe Biden's more targeted trade and industrial policy, which included subsidies for clean energy and high tech. The president has broad authority to declare an emergency and impose tariffs under a 1977 law, but a measure sponsored by Senate Democrats would nullify the emergency Trump used to permit the Canadian tariffs. Four Republicans broke ranks to support all 47 of the chamber's Democratic members and passed the legislation. Maine Republican Susan Collins backed the bill, saying her state's economy is intertwined with Canada.
Maine's paper mills, forest products businesses, agricultural producers, and lobstermen. The tariffs on Canada would be detrimental to many Maine families and our local economies.
Trump's Canadian emergency trade declaration accused the country of letting huge amounts of fentanyl cross the northern border, but Collins points out around 0.1% of fentanyl comes in over the northern border, and federal data consistently shows native-born Americans bring in the majority of the drug through legal ports of entry. Farm groups say agriculture could be an early casualty of a trade war. A U.S. Department of Agriculture study found retaliatory tariffs from Trump's first term led to more than $27 billion in lost exports over 2 years. Columbia County, New York Board of Supervisors member Michael Shimita says cuts at USDA are already making this a chaotic time for farmers.
It becomes much harder for them to predict what is the next 3 months going to be like, 6 months, 9 months. So if you take their role around looking at what are the available loans or available grant programs, all of that is up in the air. And then you add in a really chaotic approach to how tariffs could function.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
A native group selects new ambassadors to spread the word about grants. And DOGE cuts could put a strain on already precarious food security. Here's Antonio Gonzalez in National Native News.
The group Native American Jumpstart has been providing grants to Native students, interns, and young workers for decades. The application period for fall opened this week. As Kathleen Shannon reports, new this year is an ambassadors program.
9 ambassadors across the country will help spread the word on Native American Jumpstart opportunities, up to 100 microgrants per year that can help, among others, students at any level of higher education. The group's grant and operations coordinator, Wichoktvi Chattelson-Yankton, says they want to highlight more student voices and that half of ambassadors in the first cohort are current students.
So we wanted to have our ambassadors work with their Native student centers or organizations on their campus and just help bring NAJS's voice into a bigger light.
The group is funded by private donations and therefore won't be directly impacted by cuts from the Trump administration. Meanwhile, the Native American Rights Fund in March sued the U.S. Interior Department and the Office of Indian Affairs over the federal administration's cuts to the Bureau of Indian Education. O'Shea Burden Ground comes from the Great Upsalaka Nation and will graduate this spring from the University of Montana. He first used Jumpstart funding to attend a conference. Now, as an ambassador, Burden Ground encourages future Indigenous leaders to take advantage of educational opportunities.
There are a lot of opportunities out there for education and leadership development, and I wouldn't hesitate to jump on any one of those opportunities that is provided to you.
I'm Kathleen Shannon.
Alaska already imports most of its food, but for many tribes in rural areas, cuts to federal grants and staff by the Trump administration could make food security even tougher, including for farmers and reindeer herders.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 3rd.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158.
Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem.
The producer is Annette Newell and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 90.7 FM.